Hi, everybody. I'm Eben Joes, Director of Fixed Income and Alternatives at Spinnaker Trust. I'm here with our Chief Investment Officer, Jessamine Norton, and welcome to our second episode of From the Helm. Today, we're lucky enough to have Daniel Prince with us from iShares. He's been with BlackRock for over 12 years in a variety of roles, and he is currently the head of iShares U.S. Wealth Advisory Product Consulting. Daniel graduated from the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley and is a CFA charter holder like Jessamine and myself.
Yeah, we're really excited to have him today. He's been a young leader in the industry, and I don't think there's anybody that knows more about iShares and the world of ETFs.
So at Spinnaker, we've been using ETFs for about a decade now in our core models. But Daniel, I was hoping you could just jump in maybe at the top and introduce what ETFs are and how they differ from mutual funds.
Sure. Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, when you think about ETFs, let's just start with what it stands for. It's an exchange-traded fund. And, you know, I think ETFs are quite similar to mutual funds in many ways. So let's start with sort of similarities. ETFs are funds. They're generally registered under the same rules and regulations as mutual funds. They're professionally managed, right? And so in many cases, it's similar than mutual funds. Where you start to see differences is it really two reasons. One is structural. First, ETFs trade on the exchange. So buyers and sellers meet in the market versus interacting directly with the fund. This creates some efficiencies. They also trade like stocks. So there's transparency of price all throughout the day. And there's also transparency of holdings, like a stock. When you buy a stock, you know what you own. When you buy an ETF, you generally know what you own. The other aspect is really the strategy. Most ETFs today are indexed. So over the last few decades, indexing has become synonymous with ETFs, where I think most active mutual funds or active strategies have been associated with mutual funds. So really structural and strategy differences between ETFs and mutual funds.
And so at Spinnaker, we use ETFs in our core models. For example, in our U.S. equity model, we own all of the sectors in some way. Sometimes we will not own some of the smaller sectors, but for the most part, we own all of the sectors and we over and underweight to try to achieve outperformance. Maybe you could talk a little bit about how other advisors are using ETFs.
Yeah, when you think about usage of ETFs, I think it comes in many types. You know, when we sort of talk with clients, there's definitely different use cases, but let's talk about, you know, some of the main ones. First, and this is what we see most common, ETFs are generally used to build a sort of core asset allocation. You know, when constructing a portfolio, you know, it really matters how we select our asset allocation, meaning how much stocks versus bonds. It really helps align a risk profile. Many usages of ETFs have made this sort of process simpler. So, you know, one main usage, core building blocks to building an asset allocation. You also see a lot of uses for investors looking for specific outcomes. Because of the transparency of ETFs and knowing what you're buying, you get sort of this precision so you can finely tune your portfolio. So we have a lot of advisors who look for certain outcomes like increasing yield in their portfolio or looking to sort of rein in risk and doing so in a very sort of concerted way. You also have usage, and it sounds like similar to what you're doing, is using ETFs, indexes to outperform markets. So using ETFs tactically, moving in between sectors, moving in between countries and regions, really trying to find opportunity, not the stock or bond level, but at the market level. So moving in and out of markets or sectors to outperform a broad benchmark. So really strategic uses, tactical uses, outcome uses are really the lion's share of how advisors are using ETFs today.
Daniel, could you talk a minute about, you know, let's say 5 years ago, how did you think advisors were using ETFs versus how they're using them today? We know that the growth in ETFs has been tremendous, but it seems like the way that portfolios are constructed are entirely different. My sense is that the advisors were putting their toe in the water in terms of ETFs, perhaps for only international or fixed income several years ago, but now they can make up the bulk of a portfolio.
Yeah, Jessamine, I think you really hit on, you know, a big shift we've seen in the usage of ETFs. And I'll just say it from the onset. Like, I think ETFs have gone mainstream. I think most folks today know ETFs and clients ask about ETFs. But if you go back that 5-10 years, not so much. And, you know, when you think about the industry, really started in the early 90s. And, you know, you talked a little bit about the growth. It took about 16 years to hit the first trillion in assets in the ETF industry. Then it took just a handful of years to get to the next trillion, just a year and a half, the next trillion. So you see that growth sort of coming really quickly over the last decade. And I think there's been a mind shift in how people think about ETFs. Early days, most folks, most investors used ETFs for liquidity and access and trading. So early day ETFs, it was all about getting in the market for a short period of time, getting out of the market. Over time, as sort of the data has come out and shown, like investing strategically in ETFs has been sort of a rewarded value proposition. So you've seen a shift where portfolios were using on the fringe for tactical bets to now being placed sort of at the core or the heart of the portfolio. So really this sort of shift in using ETFs marginally to now using them for the mainstay of building out an asset allocation. It's just a huge shift that has led to a tremendous amount of assets in the ETF industry over the last 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, I've read a lot about how perhaps a decade ago, the advisory community still put their value proposition on stock picking. They were stock pickers. And that has really shifted to being asset allocators and partners in financial planning and other parts of the value proposition, if you will, thanks to ETFs.
Absolutely. I mean, ETFs have made sort of the investing part a little bit simpler. You know, I like to think about ETFs as bridging the gap between implementing an asset allocation, creating an asset allocation and implementing it. So it's really, we've seen that shift in the industry that you spoke to. You know, advisors are becoming more holistic in planning, becoming, you know, more sort of focused on building asset allocation. It's funny, I go to a lot of industry conferences, as you can imagine. And you know, you sort of hear from that like Nobel laureate about like how important asset allocation is. And then we all go into breakout sessions, we talk about how awesome our funds are. And you know, there's a little bit of a disconnect between, you know, what is gonna be the biggest driver of returns, asset allocation, and then implementations. I think, you know, again, advisors are sort of seeing the data, they're seeing, you know, how to scale their business, the simplicity and ease and benefits of ETFs. And, you know, for me, I've been at iShares BlackRock for about a little over a dozen years. It's been about education, you know, debunking myths or sort of showcasing that ETF structure is sort of robust and battle tested. And, you know, really, if you think about it, the ETF industry has been a challenger to the broader sort of fund industry. You know, reducing fees, you know, and sort of collecting assets along the way, it's really challenged conventional norms. So for us, it's been about education, right? It's about the transparency and how they work. And, you know, over time, I think it clicks for investors and, you know, the adoption curve follows, you know, the education efforts.
Right. No, it's interesting at Spinnaker because Eben and I are part of a team that manages a tactical ETF strategy, but also picks stocks for two very different U.S. equity funds. So we see both sides of it. And, you know, the ETF strategy for us is much larger. And I don't think that our clients are now so accustomed to the low cost, the tax flexibility. I just don't think that we could ever go back.
Daniel, you mentioned myths before, and I want you to try to debunk one of the big ones, which is, you know, the underlying securities and ETFs, the ones that don't trade as much, for example, bonds, can cause problems for fixed income ETFs. Obviously, high yield bonds, some of these bonds just don't trade every day. How do ETFs deal with that? And how have they traded in times of stress?
That's
in the past?
Number one criticism that we might hear from our client base. And I think that's largely fed by CNBC. Certainly our holdings haven't had any issues over the last decade. But if you could elaborate on that, that would be great.
Sure. Common myth we come across. And, you know, let's just say what it is. Fixed income ETFs have been out since 2002. We launched the first one in 2002. So for anyone that sort of challenges fixed income liquidity, or the fixed income ETF structure hasn't been challenged. I'd like to remind everyone that they survived and prospered during the global financial crisis. So, you know, that is an event that I think shows the wares of the structure. So they've been out, they work. But let's address that myth. So, you know, I think where investors get a little hung up on ETF liquidity, and especially fixed income liquidity, is, you know, the industry has done a good job educating that every ETF has two sources of liquidity. The ETF that trades on the exchange, so buyers and sellers meeting every day, forming an ADV, so an average daily volume, just like what stocks have, where we can see how much trades and what the spreads are, every sort of market participant through what's called the national best bid and offer gets to see this volume. So that's the ETF volume. To the extent that there is more volume or buying or selling demand of an ETF, it starts to tap the underlying liquidity of the ETF if there's not enough liquidity in the ETF itself. Okay. So what a lot of folks should know is that many ETFs have formed their own liquidity pool, meaning every day investors show up to trade some ETFs. So let's go through an example. We have a high yield fund, HYG. And HYG generally on most days trades over $1 billion a day. On most days, generally speaking, the spread is about 1 cent wide. So 1 basis point of spread, and that's our measure of liquidity, like spreads. And it has its own liquidity pool. Investors show up every day to trade HYG. In fact, HYG trades more than 24 of the 30 stocks that sit inside the Dow Jones Industrial Average Index. So trades more on average than companies like Johnson & Johnson. It has its own liquidity pool, and it can service all that liquidity, and it does not need to really trade the underlying bonds within to meet investor demand. So I think, you know, what folks miss out on is, let's think about stocks. When a stock IPOs, you take private shares to the market. There is no underlying assets, right? Like, let's think about Microsoft. You know, you can't exchange spreadsheets and cloud-based computing for shares of Microsoft. That sort of mechanism doesn't exist. The liquidity is 100% contingent on investors meeting in the market, forming an average daily volume, and creating a spread. And they show up every day. And so it's really no different for a fixed income ETF that has its own ADV. I hope that helps bring clarity and not more confusion to sort of a common myth out there. But bottom line is, investors should really look at the ADV of the ETF to really establish the liquidity, and not forget about, but don't incorporate the underlying liquidity if an ETF trades very well itself.
I see. So there's a difference between pricing of underlying holdings and liquidity overall. I think that stat you gave about the largest names in the Dow versus HYG is kind of stunning. I didn't know that.
Yeah, that is interesting. So does that mean investors should avoid ETFs with low AUM? How do you think about those? There's a lot of new ETFs that come onto the market. They have under 100 million in AUM. They probably don't trade as much every day. How should investors view those types of ETFs?
Oh, and just to interject, AUM for our listeners is assets under management.
Thank you.
Yep.
It depends, you know, and I would say, you know, it's not a good heuristic or rule to just say, let's just avoid any ETF under 100 million, right? You want to take into account that, like, every ETF is liquid. Right. The definition of liquidity really is, you know, can you trade it? Yes. The real question is at what price? So, you know, there's two things to really think about. One is, you know, if you have a good strategy that you're really interested in, there's nothing else out there, and, you know, it's sub $100 million, and you look at the liquidity and the spreads aren't as tight as they could be, but you're comfortable with the liquidity, that's not a bad value proposition. Okay. The other thing to think about is how ETFs are created and redeemed, which I was speaking about earlier. Like, there is two levels of liquidity. So let's say, for example, I sort of moved from BlackRock, and tomorrow I started up my own firm and launched an S&P 500 ETF. Even though it would be sub 100 million, the underlying market is extremely liquid. And I would expect the ETF, which again has low AUM or assets under management, maybe even a low ADV, to still be relatively liquid because it's investing in a liquid market. So, you know, really, you know, I wouldn't say that under 100 million is necessarily a bad thing. You just need to be mindful of the liquidity. And the good news is that spreads are available. They're basically publicly available to see what the liquidity looks like. So any trading platform you go in will show you that. So that's the nice thing about ETFs. You know your liquidity in advance as you execute. So, you know, judge each ETF in that own right and understand that the underlying market can be a source of liquidity when the fund is relatively small.
No, thanks for that. We still get a lot of questions about ETFs. Perhaps they've lessened over the years as our clients have benefited from the use of ETFs. But thank you for that explanation. I don't think there's anyone better out there to explain. Can we switch gears a little bit? And we wanted to ask you about some areas of innovation within the world of ETFs. So I think most people who are casual observers of the industry still just think of it as passive market cap weighted indexes, but there's a lot happening. If you could touch upon that.
Yeah, there's a lot going on. Keeps us busy, keeps me busy. Let's throw out some numbers real quick. You know, just iShares alone. So one sponsor, we are a sponsor of ETFs. We are a manager of ETFs. Our brand is iShares. We are part of BlackRock, the asset manager. Just iShares alone, we have 356 products today in the market space. So, you know, it's clearly not just a handful of funds, you know, tracking just a couple big broad indexes that make up the market. And in fact, when you extend this out to the sort of whole landscape, there's over 2,000 ETFs that trade on U.S. exchanges today. So I think, you know, one of the fun parts about working in the ETF industry is really trying to think through, like, what's the next wave of innovation? How can we further add progress to investors? How do we further bring value or unlock value leveraging transparent indexes at the intersection of an efficient ETF structure? So let's start listing off some of the innovations that we've seen over the last few decades. And again, going back to the early 90s, you know, you saw just a couple broad indexes that are pretty well known, household names launched, folks use them as liquidity tools. In the early 2000s, you see a really huge launch around market cap weighted indexes. So as you mentioned, you know, sort of just owning a particular market, whether it's owning large cap stocks or small cap or emerging, market cap weighted. But as you started to see the evolution throughout the 2000s, you saw different asset classes get access to, like commodities. So efficiently being able to trade like gold or broad commodity futures. You saw innovation around fixed income access. So again, unlocking sort of efficiencies to gain access to investors. You've also seen, you know, what were traditionally active manager strategies, things like tilting towards factors. So the sort of academic bent towards investing that sort of, you know, rooted in a lot of financial theory around tilting your portfolio towards what's called factors like value stocks or stocks that are cheaper relative mm-hmm. to their peers on a fundamental basis.
Yeah, the Fama French stuff, the beginning of it all.
Right, Fama French. So a lot of factor-based strategies. Again, this is sort of blurring the line on what we think of as indexes, right? And it's active in the sense that it's trying to outperform the market, but it's index in that it's rules-based and generally low cost. So factor-based indexes, you see a lot around ESG today. So ESG sort of innovation in the ETF space continues to really hum at a quick rate right now.
Right, and if I might interject, again, ESG stands for environmental, social, and governance. So it's weighting stocks or evaluating stocks and indices on the basis of that framework.
Absolutely, we see a lot of innovation there. You know, and even thematic-based ETFs, we launched a platform at BlackRock last year called our Megatrends platform. So thinking about, you know, the future of society over the next few decades and sort of these transformational shifts we're seeing across demographics, climate change sort of concerns, technology changing the way we are. So we have funds through innovation that are focused on sort of capturing those themes. So, you know, I'd say if there's any industry that's sort of rife for innovation, it's really the ETF world, thinking about what are those indexes that best capture investor demand and changes in our society and how we invest.
Thank you for that. That's awesome. It's been quite a ride. To think that all of this has really happened in 20 years is pretty remarkable. We wanted to ask you a little bit about Aladdin and iShares and BlackRock's positioning in terms of, you know, I think people associate BlackRock with iShares only, but, you know, for most advisory firms, there's a great option hosted by BlackRock to help you with risk management and portfolio weightings. And if you could speak a bit about Aladdin, it's a tool that we rely on at Spinnaker.
Sure. Yeah. Aladdin is definitely not a household name, but you know, really the history of BlackRock is rooted on sort of this notion that our founders had in the late 80s. It's like investors need to have a better understanding of the risks that they're taking in their portfolio. And really, that's sort of the bedrock of BlackRock is risk management. Yeah, we have a lot of mutual funds. We have a lot of ETFs. We have a lot of different ways that investors can access. We are sort of the world's largest asset manager by AUM. But really underpinning all that is this idea of knowing what you own and what risks you're taking with that ownership. So Aladdin is our risk management system. It allows us to understand the different risks in each portfolio through sort of like robust analytics. It also helps us manage our whole platform on an end-to-end process. So it's really seamless. It helps us scale up our internal systems so that our portfolio managers can efficiently talk to our traders, who can efficiently talk to our folks that sort of govern our process. But it's also gone out to clients in the form of really decomposing what holdings they have and thinking about the risks that they're taking, whether it's sensitivities to things like interest rates, whether it's sort of looking at scenarios like what would happen in a world if gold prices went up 20%. So thinking about the different scenarios and how your portfolio would be positioned, because we think the biggest risk that people take in the portfolio are the risks that they're not aware of. And what Aladdin is trying to do is bridge that gap. And really, it's a function of the advancements in technology and data that have enabled us to build this platform to most efficiently analyze our portfolio. So it's actually good for me to hear that you're using this with your platform today to help understand any potential risks that you weren't aware of that are brought up to the consciousness of how you manage your portfolio. That's important for us.
Yeah, no, I'd offer two comments on that. One, using Aladdin now, we could have gotten similar results in using some of our own vendors like FactSet, but it's very expensive to do so. So it's helped us save costs, and also we've received the same level of risk analysis for our portfolios, which is awesome. And the second thing I'd offer is that for U.S. equities, again, Eben mentioned that we are, we're tilting sectors, or it's loosely a sector rotation model. But factors are now so important, and those encompass several sectors at a time. So we think it's very important for us to know what our factor exposure is, even though we're looking at U.S. sectors. And Aladdin helps us to do that. We, I personally run it probably monthly, and we talk about it quarterly. So it's a great tool for us.
Well, glad it's not only a great tool, but it's also cost effective for you. That's a real time feedback from our clients is an amazing thing. So thank you for that.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you for letting us use Aladdin.
Just one comment on that real quick. We've sort of talked about like investor demand a little bit and the evolution and like sort of risk management and how it brings insights to you. I think like underpinning all of this is just the sort of society's march towards efficiencies, transparency, and leveraging sort of like data. Like all of that means ETFs have been more successful and you are running your portfolios with a better eye on risk. And we can actually offer that as a service because we've scaled up our side. So I think, all of what we're talking about is really this sort of innovation at the intersection of efficiencies, transparencies, really driving value, right? Like I think Target's tagline is expect more, pay less. Like, I think they got that right? Clients are expecting more and they want to pay less over time for that because things get more efficient. This is that sort of efficient frontier moving out because of technology that we learned about.
Yeah. And I mean, the number one beneficiary of this are clients.
That's right.
Our last question for you today is we just wanted to, open the book a little bit and ask you what the future looks like for ETFs. So we've talked about factors, market cap weighted indices, thematic offerings? You know, what do you think is next?
Yeah, well, simply, there's probably going to be more products than less in the future. And you know, when I think about our internal product innovation, we think about it through a couple different dimensions. You know, one is access. So this sort of evergreen unlocking of access for investors is something you're going to continue to see from the likes of an iShares and other ETF providers. So, you know, think about different global economies opening up their capital markets, and what was previously inaccessible now becoming accessible, or new asset classes forming and ETFs being sort of created to track those. So, for example, you know, in 2014, the U.S. Treasury launched its first floating rate Treasury bond. Ever, right? It launched 2014. Within a few days, we launched an ETF tracking that new asset class. I thought that was really cool. We worked on something that was like not yet out. So one area of what the future holds is just unlocking access. New markets are going to open up. ETFs will be an efficient, perhaps more liquid way to access those, and you'll sort of see that continue to happen. The other sort of avenue of future innovation is around different strategies. So, you know, think about different strategies that are formed, you know, maybe like you, like how you use indexes to be active, right? Like through your sort of sector rotation model, thinking about strategies that can work in a rules-based format, you know, that sort of continue this sort of, let's remove some of the frictions, let's reduce the cost, let's bring transparency, but let's bring an active strategy to market. Or perhaps it's an alternatives strategy to market. So you'll see more sort of innovation in the sort of alternative space or active strategies now becoming transparent indexes. And then lastly, in the industry, you know, you're also seeing, we've seen some rules from the SEC around active ETFs. So I think in the market, you'll see sort of active strategies that traditionally were in a mutual fund structure now come to the market in the ETF structure and be labeled as active, not converting to an index-based approach. So I think those are some of the areas. And again, I can't opine on, you know, what we've have or have not filed for and speak, you know, appropriately, but those are some high-level contours of the future of innovation. Access, active strategies turning index, and traditional active strategies now in the ETF structure would be three main ways that I would think about that.
Yeah, well, we look forward to more innovation, and certainly there's been a lot over the last few years, and we're sure there's more to come. Eben, do you have any other questions?
I don't. I think that's a great wrap up, and thank you so much for spending time with Jessamine and I today, Daniel. We appreciate it.
Yeah, we're huge admirers of iShares and BlackRock. They've been great helpers in our process over the years. And we're, you know, in speaking with people like you, we know why it's such a great company to work with. So thank you so much.
Well, let me just say this on behalf of BlackRock. Thank you for having us. This is exactly, you know, sort of our mission, you know, education, sort of like bringing sort of transparency what the industry is all about. So thank you for having me on your podcast. And appreciate our conversation that we had today.
We hope you enjoyed that podcast with Daniel Prince from iShares and BlackRock. We work with BlackRock a lot. They're a valuable partner of ours, and so we were really happy to have him. Eben and I would like to wish you a great holiday season. We hope to bring you some different content in the month of December. You know, in the meantime, have a great holiday season. Thanks a lot.